Well, that indeed has set the scene for our speaker. I'm not sure how much energy he's got left because he hasn't touched the ground since he got here. He just had done a full-on Winchester convention. I think they squeezed a bit more out of him at Al-Anon last night. But I'd love to welcome, and I heard you on Saturday night. You're in for a real treat if you haven't already heard him. Please will you welcome Ken from San Diego, California.
Hi, my name is Ken, and I'm an alcoholic, and glad to be here in jolly old England. I was listening to Matt do the countdown, and sometimes in the course of the countdown, we lose track of the fact that it's not about the person who has the most sobriety. It's about the newcomer. And when I see, like, Stuart and Mark have 24 hours, take a 24-hour trip, that it just lets me know that everything is okay because we're able to stay here, and alcohol is still mangling enough people to send them in here to join us. You know, the mangling effect. We don't get here until we're completely mangled. That's a great, great line from the Big Book. And when you read it, you say to yourself, when I did, because I got through school totally unscarred by education, I went and said, what does mangle mean? And it means bone crushing. Not just like, you know, a little tap, but bone crushing. And that's about what it takes. I mean, I don't know how many of you folks ever saw that movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Anybody ever see that? You know, it's kind of like the Black Knight. He's lost his legs and his arms, and he's on the bridge saying, come on back here, I can still bite. You know, like, and that's the way alcoholics are in terms of alcoholism. We just don't surrender. I mean, we're clubbed in here step by step. But I'm really glad to be here. And I was also thinking that that when we arrived, Carol and I arrived on the 20th, I didn't know anybody. I knew absolutely, I mean, I had talked to Kevin and Annie, who were so nice to us during the whole process of getting us here, but I didn't know anyone. And now, tonight, when I was walking in here, I thought, I know a lot of people here. I've had a chance to talk to them. I've had a chance to listen to them, tell me what's going on with them. And since I've been here, as Teresa mentioned, I've been just, Carol and I have just been really, really busy. I mean, between Kevin and Annie, you know, doing stuff. We came out of immigration there at the airport and were greeted by Kevin and Matt. Now, that's a treat. You know, you're 10 and a half hours in a plane. You're an hour getting through. And you come out and you're half dazed. And you see Matt. And that's before the haircut tonight. Tonight he has a haircut. And I thought, God, this is great. And then Kevin came rushing over, and the next thing you know, we were in the process. And Carol said, I hope they realize they're driving on the wrong side. And I said, don't worry. It will all work out, you know. And then that just started the whole deal going. You know, yesterday we were with Kingsley and Gavin, and we got to see a lot of things over that we would have not seen and got to visit with them. And today we had a real hoot with Steve. I mean, Steve took us out in a cart, and we had two horses, and he and I were up front, and I got to see the horse shit. I've never, you know, I have dealt with horse shit all my life and never knew where it really came from, you know. And here it was. I was seeing the delivery system, you know, like, and the horse kind of knew he was showing off because he did it two and then three times, you know, like, and I thought, wow, this is great. And people that you didn't know a few days ago, now you know them well. And last night we were at the Al-Anon meeting, and I got to meet and talk with and listen to the Al-Anon people. And it's like, you just don't realize, at least I have to constantly remind myself how grateful I am for the opportunity to be sober. because, you know, when I was getting here, in the process of getting here, I wasn't always so popular, you know. You know, people used to think I looked best when all they saw was my elbows and my ass. You know, I was leaving, you know, like that was a good picture of me. But coming towards them, it was like, time out, you know, like, and my mother, God love her, she loved me very much, but she used to say, you know, drunk or sober, you are no day at the beach, you know, and I wasn't a day at the beach. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, for those of you who have less than a year, welcome to God's daycare, you know. This is God's daycare for his kids with special needs, you know, like, these are the people who are not subject to local, state, or federal authority, you know, like, you know, people who say, who, me? I couldn't possibly be me, you know. So the reality is, and you have to be careful talking to newcomers because they have impaired hearing, you know. We have a guy in our area who told one of his new guys, he said, don't make any major decisions in the first year. And the guy followed his advice. He kept drinking, you know, like, you know. So that's just the way it goes, you know. They hear stuff. And the old-timers, sometimes they jump in, and they're trying to be helpful, but they're not really helpful. You know, this kid shared in San Diego. Of course, it's a different environment, but this kid said, 2 weeks ago, I was in a jacuzzi, hot tub, and he said, there were three naked women and me, and I had all the booze I wanted. And this guy who had 35 years, when he got to share, he said, don't worry, you'll never have to go through that again. You know, like, you know, like, you know, like, I mean, you say, don't help, you know, leave him alone. Give him a chance to do some of this other stuff. But, you know, you being sober, you get to do stuff. After 9/11 happened, the world seemed like it went crazy again. You know, it just seemed like it went crazy. People had all this anger and frustration and didn't know where to vent it. And I prayed about what I should be doing instead of watching what they were doing. And it came to me very clearly that I needed to get where it was peaceful and serene. So what I did was I gave away everything I owned, clothing, possessions of every kind, and got down to 6 Xerox boxes where they store the paper. And I put pictures in those boxes, and I took off for New Mexico. And people said, you know, we think you've lost your mind. And I said, not yet, but I'm really working on it. You know, like, and so I went, and I went to a couple of meetings on the Navajo reservation, and I got to meet these guys, and somehow we just clicked. And they said, would you like to live out here with us? And I said, sure. So here I was, a New York boy, living on a Navajo reservation in New Mexico. And it was a great experience because just like someone corrected, not didn't correct, but brought to my attention, when I mentioned hitting a guy with a garbage can, and he said, "There, in this country, we don't say that. We say it's a bin lid or a lid bin or something different." And I said, well, thanks for that upkeep, because next time I'll hit him differently, you know. But I got to be really close to these guys, but they had a different deal. Thanksgiving was coming up, and I said to him, you know, like, I don't want to be offensive because I'm here with you folks. I want to adhere to your culture. Like, is Thanksgiving a big deal? And they kind of looked at me funny. And they said, well, the first one was. They said, we showed up with turkeys and all kinds of food and stuff. He said, but we thought it was a going away party. You know, we thought you were going to get back on those boats and get the hell out of here and we get all our stuff back. He says, you never hear of the second Thanksgiving. You know, like, by that time we had pretty much wised up. But the deal is that just learning to be around these guys. And I hooked up with this medicine man who called me White Pony Man because I drove a white car at that time. Click Clock was my name in Navajo. Click Clock. So he used to look at me sometimes. And I said to him one day, you really enjoy me. And he said, yes. He said, I really do. He said, because we used to ride around the wagon trains in circles. He said, somehow, you're not a Navajo and you've perfected that. You know, you're going in circles, you know. Like, and I thought, I think he's complimenting me that I'm getting back to the Head Start program here, like getting going in the right way. But anyway, I remember going out, and I think Gavin yesterday mentioned being in Durango, and Durango is on one side of the mountain, and New Mexico is on the other side. And out there, they have some of the best fly fishing in the world. They go out and they have the San Juan River comes down out of the mountains, and there's a big dam on the reservation called the Navajo Dam. And they have some of the best trout fishing in the world there because the water is created to be nice and warm, and the trout just come there. So we used to go out there and take blankets and go up into the hill and light fires and a little fire and watch eagles fly because the Navajo love eagles. Eagle is a big status symbol for the American Native American. And when they do a deal, they put an eagle's feather on the table. And then if you violate the deal, you're in big trouble. You're in big trouble. So we went up, and we were watching the eagles, and then we started to get fixed a little bit on these guys who were doing this trout fishing, you know, flying in their flout, throwing those rods out, the line out. Anyway, this one guy was there. They guarantee you, if you buy a pass there, that if you don't catch a fish, you don't have to pay. That's how sure they are you're going to catch it. So this guy had a fish, a trout on there, and he kind of wheeled it in a little bit, and eventually he got it, picked it up, and we were fascinated watching this. And he took that fly, that little fly, out of its mouth and put it back in the water, and off it went. Because they do this thing called catch and release. You know, I'm from Brooklyn. We do catch and fillet. So I watched him, and off went the fish. And without us knowing it, down came this eagle. Just went across the water, dropped its talons in the water, and snagged that fish and took off. And this medicine man never turned his head. He was just sitting next to me. And he said, "Do you ever have a day like that?" Yeah. Did you ever have a day like that? And I said, I sure have, where you think you're leaving the scene of an accident, only to find out you are the accident. You know, like, I said, geez, you know, I can't get over this. This is an amazing deal. And so you learned, and I learned there, that there's a peace and a serenity in doing nothing. Just laying on your back and watching clouds go by. And realizing that clouds don't have any destination. They just go where the wind blows them. And the clouds never repel anything. The things go right through them. They don't stop. They don't fight with anything. If you want to fly through, come on. And I got to watch. And I realized that you could actually live life like that. You could actually develop spiritually to the point where your circumstances didn't make any difference, and you could allow things to happen without feeling like you had to get involved and change them all the time. And I thought, boy, that would certainly take a lot of angst out of my life if I could master this. And prior to moving to the reservation, I had volunteered in the hospice program in San Diego, working with people who were dying. And I got to meet some of the nicest people who weren't going to be in this world too long. And those two things, the hospice and the reservation, combined. Because what I learned from the hospice was, it doesn't matter what your agenda is. Eventually, there's an agenda that's bigger than that. You know, like we said the other night, there's somebody bigger than Phil. You know, like, and the deal is that takes over and allows life to happen. And as it starts to happen, you realize that you're really not in charge of a whole lot. The very first guy I got to work with was this guy, Stanley. And I went out to work with him, and he was very angry. And they said he had tuberculosis, and he had cancer of the lung, and he wouldn't last more than 2 weeks. Well, I started working with him, going there and just being there for a couple hours a day with him. And he was very angry. They were right. And I said to him, why are you so angry? And he said, you wouldn't understand. This was in 1983. And he said, you wouldn't understand. And I said, well, try me. He said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I should have gotten a 39-year cake. And I can't get to the meetings because I'm too weak. And then he said something else. I won't repeat it. And but it had to do with him being upset. And I said to him, holy, and I said something that I won't repeat. And I said, Stanley, I'm 13 years sober in AA. And he said, no, and whatever we can say. And so I said, tomorrow I'm going to load you up on morphine and take you to a noon meeting I know. So I did that, and I got to give him a 39-year cake. And under the wisdom and care and so forth of the doctors, the 2 weeks turned into 2.5 years. And I got to give him a 40-year cake. And guys used to come over my house, weepers and whiners, you know, oh, kid, she's leaving, you know. Kid, she's staying, you know. And I say, look, you know, can we spend some time together? And I say, look, you know, I can't spend time with you right at the moment, but I can in an hour or two. But we first got to go down and see my buddy Stanley. So I used to take him down to see Stanley. And we'd go in his room, and Stanley would be, at this point, after about a year or so, he weighed about 75, 80 pounds. There was nothing to him. They had him on oxygen, and they were trying to pump protein into his body and keep him alive. And I'd go in, and I'd say, Stanley, this guy's having trouble in AA, staying sober today. And Stanley would whip that oxygen off, and he'd say, wow, sober in AA, how good does it get, you know? Living here in San Diego, are we lucky? Yeah. And I say to these guys, they look, and most of the time they really cuss me out. And then we go out in the hall, and I say to them, now tell me about your problems. You know? I got time now to listen. Tell me about it. Come on. You know, like, and the deal is, our problems are of our own making. You know, if we didn't hang on to them, they would just go away. And Stanley in the hospital, they couldn't understand. They'd have him on, at the end, they had him on this medicine called Ensure, which is supposed to be for cancer patients. He couldn't keep anything down. And I'd show up every day with coffee from the Dunkin' Donuts and 2 jelly donuts. And he would drink the coffee and eat the donut. And the nurse would say, we can't figure this out. You know, like, he can't keep down Ensure, and yet he's probably taking in the worst thing to digest, black coffee and a jelly donut. And I said, lady, he's been doing this for 40 years. You know, like, it's the only thing keeping him alive. And he would do that. And then in the afternoon, they told me he would go take a nap, and when he woke up, he would finish off the coffee and the second jelly donut. So one day I went in there, and they told me he was in depression. You notice, when people don't know what's going on with you, they have a label. There's always a label. In his case, he was in depression. So I went in, and there he was, and I said, Stanley, how you doing? And he didn't respond, and I tried to talk, and he was just laying there not moving, playing like he was in depression, you know. And so after a few minutes of trying to cajole him into doing something, I took the sheet and pulled it up over his head. And I said, thank God. Now he's out of here. I can have this coffee. And he never took the sheet off. He just said, you know, Ken, you're not always funny. But that's the way life is. It's always just happening. And if you're an alcoholic, you spend most of your life getting ready for it. never doing it, getting ready for it. You know, like, what are you going to do next week, next year, in 6 months, and tomorrow, when John comes home, when Mary comes back, when Joe goes out? I mean, it's like, and most of the stuff we're getting ready for is never going to happen. We're better prepared for stuff that doesn't happen to us than stuff that actually does, you know? We have a funny mind, you know? It's like the alcoholic who's sitting at the bar with his wife, and he leans forward and he says, "I love you." And she says, "Is that you talking or is that the beer talking?" He said, "It's me talking to the beer," you know? And So this is the way the mind works of the alcoholic. You know, we're never where we're supposed to be. We're always visiting other dimensions. You know, it's like we're not there. And the bottom line is that all of the steps, people say that we shouldn't think and stuff. If you take time, and time, by the way, is the most used noun in the English language. There's no noun used more than time. You got the time? You have enough time? I have to get there on time. I got there too early. I got to save some time. I got to kill some time. I mean, time is just part of the deal. And the only time there ever is right now. Present. You know? If we weren't around and two giraffes met, you wouldn't see them say, "Hey, you got the time?" You know, like, it doesn't work that way. The deal is that we've made it up. People even say to me, "Well, what did you do with the 8 hours you lost coming over here? Your watch changed 8 hours." I said, "I was sitting in a seat. Yeah, I was doing exactly what I was doing if I wasn't coming here. You know, like, do you think I somehow lost that time? Gained that time? Nothing happens to it. It's always right now. And this is where we live. And this is the only place we can think, feel, act, and accomplish anything. It's right now. And that's why if you look at the word now spelled backwards, it's won. W-O-N. When you've learned to live in the now, you've won. If you're trying to live anyplace else, you're going to just be spinning your wheels. That's why in the literature it says, "There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him Thursday." You know, like, it doesn't work that way. That's just not the way it works, you know. I fortunately have hung out with guys in sobriety who are just guys who know how to be where they're at. We had a guy who used to come to where he's passed away. A lot of these guys pass away. And his name was Lewis. And Lewis got sober when he was 50. And he used to mop up the drunk tank at the jail, the county jail. And he'd come to meetings and be wearing work boots and socks and that looked like they were left over from World War I. And he always had those short pants that never touched the top of his shoes. And he'd wear a pair of pants that had red suspenders, but only one was connected. You know, I love this guy. I mean, I just loved him. He was so simplistic. I mean, people would try to get him into nonsense, and he would just look at him funny. He would read the Reader's Digest. And when reading the Reader's Digest, they have the word power. So Lewis would have his finger in the section where the word was and his finger in the other section where the answers were. And he'd be flipping it back and forth, looking at the word, getting the answer, looking at the word. And, you know, people with a lot of time, 6-7 days, would come over to him and say, "That's not the way you do that. The way you do that is you look at the word, and then there are 4 alternatives as to which one best describes that word. You guess at which one you think is the best, and then when you're all done, you go to where the answers are." And Lewis would look at them in the most simplistic way and say, "Why would I guess if I know where the answer is?" And then they'd walk away. And then and Lewis would be back to doing his deal. I was there one day. I called it my epiphany with Lewis, because I was there one day and people were talking about, how do you solve problems? I'm sure that doesn't come up at any of the AA meetings you go to or Al-Anon meetings. How do you solve this problem? And people were getting up. I make inventories. I go to the beach. I fly with the eagles. I drown myself. I play with the fish. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And then Lewis got up there, and he always said the same thing. I'm Lewis, and I come here because I'm really trying to stay sober. And he reached in his pocket. He pulled out a silver dollar. He says, when I have a problem to solve, I flip this. Heads, I do it this way. Tails, I do it that way. I'm 35 years sober. I can live with it either way. And then he went to go sit down. And then right before he got to his seat, he stopped and he said, by the way, it's not 2 out of 3. One flip is enough. You know, give it one flip and that's it. And that's the way we are. We don't know how to... You hear people say, well, I'm powerless. We're powerless, but we're not helpless. You know, we're not helpless. We can take the action not knowing how it's going to turn out. And the deal is just enjoy taking the action. Learn to do what you can do and not what you can't, you know? And it seems as though all of the problems that I hear are perceptional problems. You know, people, what's going on in their mind? This, and this. And as I said, it always reminds me of a snail sitting on a turtle going, wee, you know, like the deal is that it's not about what's happening. It's about what we think is happening. And then we start trying to come up with an answer for it, and there really is no answer for it. And I love working with newcomers because they have those kind of in the moment trying to learn. And that's why I love kids. Kids always are in the moment. You never hear a kid say, well, I think I'm going to go play in a sandbox in 2 or 3 hours. You know, kids just do it. They don't know how, you know, is today tomorrow or is yesterday today? I mean, they don't know. And that's the way it's supposed to be. And I love kids because they've always given me the best answers. I was in an elevator with a little kid. He couldn't have been more than 10. And he was scratching his head. And, of course, I love talking to kids. So I said, why are you scratching your head? He said, because I'm the only one who knows it itches. I mean, is that deep or what? You know? I mean, I said, hey, the Dalai Lama. You know, like, he knows not only why he's doing it, but that he knows he's doing it. This is great. But that's the way kids are. I was down in Seaport Village. Some of you mentioned you got out to the International in 1995 in San Diego. And that's where it was held. It was held down on the bayfront in Seaport Village. And this time of the year, we have what's called June gloom in San Diego. And the clouds come down. They kind of block out the sun. And these kids were flying kites. And I walked by this kid, about 12 years old, and he had a kite in the air. And as I walked by him, you couldn't see his kite. It was above the clouds. And I said to him, how do you know your kite is still there? And he looked at me without losing a second, and he said, because I can feel the pull of it, mister. I can feel the pull of it. And that's the way it works with us in the spiritual end. When we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, we feel the pull of it. And when we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing, we feel the pull of that. And it all comes down to just letting go most of the time and not getting involved in all this nonsense, but just letting it go and recognizing that everything is okay if we leave it alone. It seems to take on a not okayness the minute we get involved. You know, and I was so lucky because I had a good sponsor when I first came in, and he was my temporary sponsor for 34 years. And I told you about him, you know. And the deal is that, and now I have a guy who's 96 years old. He was born in November 1916. Do you think he's worried about crap? I mean, when you go to dinner with him every Wednesday night, I go to dinner with him and this other guy, and then we go to this men's meeting, And the conversation when people join us, and there's always people that join us, they're bringing all this nonsense with them, you know, but it's real to them, you know. And the perception again, you know, Ken, you know, if she leaves me, I can't stay sober, you know. Okay. Then you meet another guy in the afternoon. He says, Ken, if that bitch stays, I'm done. I can't stay sober, you know. Like it's so the reality is it's all going on between the ears. It's really not a problem. And when they come up there with Bob and they sit down with Bob, they'll start to talk and he'll casually say, oh, yeah, I remember doing that step. The first time I did it was about, oh, I think it was 70 years ago. And you just watch this kid who's about 35 go, what? You know? He said, yeah, I think I did it about 70 years ago the first time. And the bottom line is he's been through this enough and has enough life that he's not caught up in all the nonsense of it. He's just caught up in the doing it. You know, he's just caught up in the doing it. And that's why when I come to these kinds of functions where there's people Al-Anon and AA together, I think it's great. I really do. I think it's great. Because sometimes it's like they're going in two separate directions. They're two programs that go in two separate directions. And really, they're all going in the same direction, which is trying to access a power greater than themselves. And when they reach that point where they're able to access that power, then things tend to go good. You know, the spiritualist used to say it's like spiritual fire. The people who walk up into the spiritual fire and then walk right into the fire get totally burnt. And they are burnt to the point where they can never go back and be what they were before. The rest of us want to stay close to the fire and be warm, but we don't want to get burnt. We don't want to get burnt because somehow we feel, what happens to me if I stop being me? You know, the question they once asked Shakespeare, to be or not to be? Well, the only way to be is not to be. That's the only way there is. Everything else is spending time trying to become something. You know, I have to be this. I have to be that. I have to accumulate this. I have to have that. And then every now and again on the news, you'll hear people who have lost things to a fire or something, and their whole life's changed. And now that you hear them say things like, well, we'll just start over again. On the plane over here, they came around and they handed out, you had your choice of newspapers, English newspapers, and I took the Mirror. And I'm sorry, I didn't know. It was just a random choice. They had two papers, and I'll take this one. And Carol took the other one. But there was a great article in there that in London right now, there's a high rate of anxiety and almost neurotic behavior. And when they talked to these people, what they said was, we are more anxious today than we were during the Blitz. The people living in London today overall, because they don't connect to anything. They're totally non-connected. Or they connect with something so, I don't know what even word to use, they connect with it so exclusively to everybody else that the end result is they don't have anything. They just don't have anything. There was a cartoon in the paper not too long ago. I loved it. But it was two entrances into heaven. And there were two angels standing there. And under the one entrance into heaven, it said, the right religion. And the line ran infinitely. You couldn't even see the end of the line. Then the other entrance into heaven said, wrong religion. And there was nobody in that line. And the one angel says to the other angel, I don't think they get it. I don't think they get it. There isn't any right or wrong. They all came from the same home office. You know, like you were sent out from the same joint, you were sent out okay, and you're going to come back to the same office. Don't get upset. You know, like, you've got nothing to do in all eternity to get it done. Pace yourself, you know. I remember when I was a single parent, and I used to say to my kids, you know, I have a good idea. And they'd say, pace yourself, Dad. You have all idea, all day. You know, don't get going on this right away. And the deal is the gradual acceptance of the fact that really there isn't a whole lot that I have to do. I don't have to do a whole lot. And the nice part about it is when I come to meetings and I hear people say, I don't know how to meditate. I don't know how to do this. If you know how to make coffee, if you know how to set up a chair, if you know how to go and answer a phone call and help somebody else, then you know how to meditate. Because meditation is nothing more than getting out of yourself. And if you can do those things, then you can be happy all the time. You don't have to be trying to figure it all out. There's really not a whole lot to figure out. And when working with newcomers, kind of let the newcomer know where you're coming from. You know, try to... They have a chapter in the big book called Working with Others. And there are five nevers in that chapter. And when I start working with a guy, we highlight those nevers. The first is never force yourself on another alcoholic. Never. Now, I don't know. The word never for an alcoholic is scary. I don't know what they get hung up on, the ne or the ver, but it seems to throw them a curve. And the second one is to don't be critical of another alcoholic. Never be critical. And the third is never talk down to that alcoholic as though you're on some moral or spiritual hilltop. And the fourth is never avoid the responsibility of working with someone when the opportunity presents itself. You got to play the Good Samaritan every day. And then the last one is never, never attack drinking as an institution. Just this person, this is what they do. You don't want to give them the idea they're doing something wrong. And the deal is that when you get newcomers in and you start to work with them, tell the truth. Isn't it more fun than going to the circus? You know, you get two or three newcomers in your car, and your car immediately becomes a mobile psych unit. You know, you're listening to them share, and you're saying, I hope I can get there in time. You know, like get to the meeting. You know, but some of the things they're talking about, and a lot of times they're not sure of anything they're sure of. You know, I think Yul Brynner had a line like that in The King and I. There are days where I'm not sure of what I absolutely know. So we try to say two prayers. Try to teach all the newcomers, at least I do, to say two prayers. The first we read the other night, the spiritual axiom. Every time I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. It's a good prayer for a newcomer. And the second one is, Dear Lord, please don't let anything I know get in the way of something I can learn. You know, sometimes we become so locked in on an old idea, we don't know how to let it go. And it's not a good idea. But to us it is, because it's in our life. And the reality is we just don't want to let go of it. But I have found, and I'm sure you will too, that when you're working with newcomers, you can't keep them in the now. They're just never, never in the now. So I tell them, I said, you know, and you just don't think, well, I don't know if this guy's going to make it or not. The old timers used to have a great story about judging. They used to say, you know, there was a man who had no legs and no arms, and he showed up at the house of ill repute. And the madam answered the door, and looking down at him disdainfully said, just what do you think you're going to do? And he looked up at her and he said, I rang the bell, didn't I? And that's the deal. That's the deal. You may have a bell ringer that doesn't look like a whole lot when he first gets to you. You know, hey, I rang that bell. Don't rule me out, you know. And the reality of that is that you get very, very comfortable in that moment of knowing that everybody is doing the best they can, regardless of how it looks to me or anybody else. But I love working with newcomers. And the reason I like working with them is because, A, it constantly reminds me of where I came from, And B, it's a constant reminder that we're only a drink away from being that newcomer. You know, you're only a drink away from being that newcomer. And so the deal is, you know, and you learn not to have to be first all the time. That was the other lesson I learned from the old timers. You don't have to be first. When I got to AA, I had a very simple philosophy. You know, if you're not the lead dog, the view is always the same. So try to get out front, you know, try to get out front and not get caught in the back. And be aware of all the nice things that are going on around you. I mean, Carol and I don't know how many times in the last 3 or 4 days have said, like, so-and-so, naming somebody specifically, you know, how nice they were to us and what they're doing for us. And, you know, and the fact that we didn't even know these people. And suddenly they're stepping forward to help us enjoy our stay here. And they don't know us from a jar of Vicks, you know. And yet this is what they're doing. And we're having a good time. And I have learned to stay in the now. I've learned to stay as best I can in the now because I notice all my problems come when I'm not in the now, when I'm stepped out of the now, because the now is the only time I have a chance to be with God as I understand him. And if I'm not doing that, I'm missing out on a big opportunity. And I don't want to miss out on the opportunities. So I try to stay in this now. And I always remind myself that early on in sobriety, I heard the story of the man who was in Vegas. Steve was sharing a trip to Vegas today with us about an agricultural thing. And it plugged in my mind this story I used to hear about this guy was in Vegas and he saw this beautiful woman. And he said he'd like to spend the evening with her. And she said, no way. And he said, I'll give you $10,000. And within a moment, they were up in a room on a bed, nude. And she said, kiss me on the lips. And he did. And he said, I don't know. And she said, well, then kiss me on the neck. And he did. And he said, I don't know. And she said, well, kiss me on the breast. And he did. And he said, I don't know. She said, what don't you know? He said, I don't know where I'm going to get the 10 grand, you know? And this is definitely alcohol thinking, you know. You're right in the middle of a good thing and you're projecting the problem. You know, it's like, you know, there is no problem, you know, like, but we got to be doing something problematic all the time or we don't feel like we're doing something. And the whole reality of this for me has been just to slow down and try to stay right where I am. Be where I am. Be still and know that God is God. And that all I am here to do is to be of service. And that through me, God is trying to become something he's never been before. And my job is not to impede him, to allow him to do that. That's why he brought me into the world. That's why he made me with fingerprints and DNA that nobody else has ever had. I've been expected since the beginning of time, and so have you. And our whole purpose for being here is to fill that capsule that we've been given of space and time right now to do the best we can. We had the Dalai Lama in town, and that's what he talked about at the meetings. And one of the guys reminded me of the fact that at one time the Dalai Lama was up in L.A., and I just thought, well, this guy needs to be heard, so I put together a whole group of guys, and I think the cost was $50 to go hear him. And we went up to L.A., and they had a bunch of, I didn't realize it was part of a sales thing, and they had a bunch of sales guys there hawking sales stuff. And then the Dalai Lama came on last, and he said, our whole purpose for being here is to help one another. And then he turned around and went to sit down. And it was like an afterthought. He went back to the microphone and he said, for those of you who can't do that, then your primary purpose is not to hurt anyone. And he sat down. And for 100 miles home, I took a lot of guff. guy's going, Ken, I went, I paid $50 and drove all the way to L.A. to hear a guy tell me,
if you can help somebody, help them. And if you can't, then don't hurt them, you know.
Hey, I'm right now ready to hurt you. I mean, I'm 50. I'm out $50 in a whole evening. It was $20 for dinner. I'm in for $100 here, you know. And what did that guy say? He said, nonsense. Two sentences. I could have stayed home and wrote that on a postage stamp, you know. But that's just the way we are. It has a dollar value, you know. And I always think of the fact that we are in a very, very unique situation as people in recovery. And that is, it's only a mind's thought to forget where we came from. Somehow, just like that, we can forget where we came from. And I hear people say, Ken, I don't want to take any action. I'm afraid of making a mistake. I should have saved the mirror. You know, take a look at what's going on in the world. You're afraid of making a mistake? You know, what could you add to this? I mean, how could you make it any worse? You know, like, when I was in New York, I used to tell guys any day they're going to get a 500-pound halibut out of the Hudson River with an eye in the middle of his forehead saying, I want to see somebody from Dow Chemical right now. You know, like, you know, the air we breathe is bad. The rivers are polluted. You know, there's threats everywhere. They're listening to my phone. They're opening my mail. They're checking my toilet paper. I mean, come on, like... What are you going to do to upset the equilibrium of the global conditions? You know, like, there's absolutely nothing you're going to do. So just pace yourself, you know. You've got a long day ahead of you. You know, like, just pace yourself. There's not a whole lot to be done. I am going to be in a situation when we get home to celebrate a birthday. And there'll be some fuss and stuff about it. But the nice part about it is, I'll have guys remind me of how they remember me when I first came in. And that's always a great reminder, because it's like, you know, didn't have all that much going for me either. In fact, I was pretty much like Steve's horse. I was a little off balance and letting go with a lot of shit, you know, like, you know. And the deal is that I didn't know that of me at the time. I thought I was a pretty classy guy. You know, I just thought, well, hey, I'm a pretty classy guy. I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And I think of when my brothers and I used to go out and get drunk. I mean, really drunk, snot drunk. You know, we'd go to the bars, and we always drank, it seemed like, in these Irish bars, Paddy's, Houlihan's, Murphy's. I mean... And it was good there, because I was sharing with someone today, if you see two Irishmen fighting over a woman, it's not the woman they want, it's the fight, you know, like, and that's just the way they are. And we, when they had these weapons of mass destruction thing during the Bush years, and they're talking about weapons of mass destruction, it came to me one night, look at the weapons of mass destruction that we have in the bar. You know, we have shuffleboard, a metal weight in somebody's hand at this end who's drunk out of their mind, pitching it down to the other end to another drunk who's out of his mind. You know? And you say, okay, maybe that wasn't your sport. How about pool? I got a stick, you got a stick. Let's play, you know. But that wasn't my game either. My game in the bars was darts. Darts. By the end of the night, my dart would have taken on its own personality, you know. I had a brother, my oldest brother, and he would fire darts like bullets. And the more he drank, the steadier he got. His younger brother was just the opposite. As I drank more, mine would start to arch. You know, they would wander off. And they would start to visit tables where people were sitting, you know. And this one night, to show you the kind of place I was in, there was a bathroom there, and it had a break front with a break at the bottom of the break front going into the men's room. And I was really not doing well with my dart. It had taken possession of me. And I was pitching away, and nothing was happening but disaster. And finally, my brother said, throw it hard. So I threw it as hard as I could, and it kind of went, ooh. And a guy was walking in the bathroom, and the dart landed in his leg. And my brother looked at me and said, we need the dart. So I walked into the urinal and bent down, and he was doing his business, and I snagged that dart. He said, thanks. And then I went back out, and we played more darts, you know. But this was called an evening out, you know. And somebody said to me, you know, like you hear so much of the mafia in New York. There was so much mafia. But what did the Irish contribute? We contribute key words to the police lexicon. It's those hooligans are up to their shenanigans. So put them in the paddy wagon. You know, we were in everything that happened. And we would exacerbate things beyond what they should have been. I was playing miniature golf. Well, my brothers were playing miniature golf one night, and I intruded in the game. I had been drinking someplace else. And they had a windmill, and I crawled into the windmill. And I had a pint of Seagram's, and I was drinking this. And the little kids and people in Coney Island were hitting the ball into the windmill, and psh, I was throwing it back. And pretty soon it started to, what do you say here, the queue up. It started to queue up. And people couldn't get through the windmill for some reason. And finally they went and got the police. And when we saw the police coming, my brother said, here come the police. So I came out of the windmill, and my two brothers took off. And there wasn't a New York cop at that time. I couldn't outrun. But one of them came over those where they have the tires to keep the balls in, and he tripped. And as he tripped, the windmill came around and skewed his hat, just took his hat. I can't run and laugh at the same time. So I was there, like, really laughing, and I got arrested. And my brothers, of course, came back because they wanted to help me out. So my brother said to me, we were going to be taking the night court. He says, whatever you do, keep your mouth shut. I said, okay. So he said, I can pay the fine. We can go home, and Mom doesn't have to find out about this. So in the morning, they brought us before the judge, and they asked my older brother, how do you plead? Guilty. My other brother, how do you plead? Guilty. In the meantime, the cop who had fallen over the tire said that he tore his uniform. So now he wanted $60 for a new pair of pants, police uniform. And so the judge said, how do you plead? I said, I'm not sure. He said, well, it's simple, innocent or guilty. I'm not sure. He said, what are you not sure about? I said, I'm not sure this is the cop that was involved last night. He said, well, what would prove it to you? I said, can you have him move his hat to the side and lay down? Needless to say, I didn't go home that day, you know. But that's the way my mind worked. It was like always anticipating the fun of life, you know. I had no idea. I was court-ordered. I think I mentioned this the other night. I was court-ordered to a psychiatrist when I was in high school because I had some anger issues. And while I was sitting there, and he was cueing me as to what was going on, I kept saying, you know, what are you thinking? I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. And I didn't want to tell them that while we were sitting there, what I was actually thinking is, if my knees bent the other way, what would chairs look like? And I knew if I told them that, it could be a problem, you know? I kind of knew what people were thinking in terms of problem. But the deal is that that's just the way my life was going. It just went that way. And it was such that when I got to AA, I was so relieved. It was like, I remember the first year I took a cake where they gave all the cake. They had one cake at my group in New York, and they gave out all the names. And I went there, you know, how high your hopes are after 1 year to see your name on a cake and everybody knowing you got 1 year. And when I went in and I looked at the cake, I saw the rose was hanging over the K in my name, Ken. And all you could see was the EN. And my last name is Devaney. So I went to my sponsor and I said, they only have EN for my name. The K is covered up with a rose. He said, you're lucky they didn't put the D on it. It would be the end. You know, like, he said, eat the cake and be happy. You know, like, but that's the way life is. It's about eating the cake and being happy. And it takes a while before you get that. Before you get that. So with you guys here, we're going to be leaving tomorrow. We're going to really, really miss you guys because you're a very funny group. Now that I've gotten to know some of you, you're sick. I like that, you know. And some of you have both going for you. You're sick and funny, which, I mean, this is to me is a natural mix. But I would like to say that we have felt a real warmth here that we never anticipated. I mean, I knew how AA works, that the people would be nice, but it's been a genuine warmth. And Kevin and Annie and Steve and Kingsley and Matt and Gavin and all the folks who, and the crazy lady who drove us, Caroline, you know, the evil Knievel of Al-Anon. Get in if you dare, you know. I'm pulling out whether you're here or not, you know. So I just felt that real warmth, and I can't tell you how much that means to us. And when we go home and we start to talk to the folks there about this visit, that's the thing that will register. We've seen a lot of nice places. We've been to the cathedral. All of that is terrific. But it's the people we met, the people I got to talk to. Our book says we are people who would not ordinarily mix. I would have never been here if I wasn't a drunk, you know, period. It's just that simple. So we wouldn't have mixed. And here we are, we're mixing. And we're all aware of the fact of our own spiritual imperfection. And if you can keep that, if I can keep that most in my mind, that I am spiritually imperfect, then I'll never have to spend time evaluating the behavior of others. Because if I'm spiritually imperfect, my job is to work on me and not work on anybody else. And to have a good time. And I have to remind myself that it's not about being the brightest bulb in the room. You know, I always think of the story of the lion. And the lion thought he was the greatest thing in the jungle, and he walked up to the tiger and he said, who's the king of the jungle? Tiger said, you, Mr. Lion, you're king of the jungle. And then he walked up to the giraffe and he said, who's the king of the jungle? And the giraffe said, you, Mr. Lion, you're the king of the jungle. And he did the same with several other animals. And finally he got to the elephant and he said, who's the king of the jungle? And the elephant snatched him up by the tail, spun him over his head two or three times, threw him 50 yards, he hit his head on a tree, and he just slid down. And the elephant turned around and started to walk away. And the lion got up and brushed himself off. And he said, hey, just because you don't know the right answer, that's no way to behave, you know? And that's the way it is. We want to be something that we're not. And we don't seem to be able to relax and laugh and enjoy until we accept who we are, where we are, doing what we're doing. You know, in the spiritual world, when a rhinoceros is born, it's already reached the quintessence of rhinocerosity. It can't be any more rhinoceros. It's going to be the day it comes out, it's the maximum it can be a rhinoceros. But human beings, when we're born, are put on the path. And some people think it's about finding God. That's the journey. No, the journey is not where we're going, but to remember where we came from. It's not about what's out there. It's about what's in here. You can only lose what you do not have. You know? And the deal is that when you realize that God is not about being out there, He's right here. He's not about then, He's now. He's present. As we become conscious of His presence, we will lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We'll be reborn. And that's the whole deal. Being where you're at, doing what you're doing, and when you see somebody else who you feel is not doing what they should be doing, to be reminding of yourself that you are spiritually imperfect. And your job is to work on you. And if you work on you enough, the same God that helps you will help that person. And life gets pretty easy. And you get to laugh a lot. And things get really funny. I mean, you do things sometimes that makes your mate proud, and then 5 minutes later you lose that, you know. Carol and I were on a plane going to Texas. And this plane was late taking off, and this kid was behind me kicking me. Just sitting there and randomly kicking me. His father looked like he just got out of Attica. And his mother looked like she met him after he got out. And he's kicking the chair. So I get up, and Carol says, "Remember, it's a child." So I turn around and I say, "You know, Tiger, we're going to be on a 2.5 flight here, and we're late taking off, and you're kicking this chair. Just won't work for me. So please, please stop kicking. Can you do that?" And he kind of looked at me in a little bit of... So I sat down. Carol looked at me with those beautiful, beautiful green eyes, full of love, and said, "I'm so proud of you." I felt so good. I figured, this is going to be a wonderful, wonderful trip. I dozed off to sleep, which I do right away. And about 45 minutes later, when I wake up, Carol's looking at me like she's the girl in The Exorcist. Her head is spinning around. There's stuff coming out of everywhere. And she said, "Now that little bastard's sitting behind me." So that's the last thing. There's no permanence. You know, everything is impermanent. It's changing all the time. Just when you think you got it all together, it's not all together. It's just temporarily in place. And if you're going to be involved with another human being, you have to be willing to accept three things. And I think this applies to AA as well as Al-Anon. And that is, one, there's only three things that can happen. That person can leave, they can die, or they can change. But there is no permanence. And if you can't cope with someone leaving or changing or dying, you better learn to live alone. Because those are the only things that can happen. And don't expect to get a perfect person. You know, it's just not going to happen. And men, I'm giving you my final tip on healthy, good living. Just because a woman is posing questions out loud doesn't mean she's asking us to respond. I have come to find out that asking questions into the ether is how women basically get going to do something. You know, like, you know, they're venting or cleansing or whatever they're doing. It's just like, and then you give an answer. "I don't remember asking you. I was talking to the ether." You know, you don't interrupt me. But that's the way it is. And men are so logical. And women are so subjective, you know, I guess is the best word. They're not into the logic end of it, you know. It's like the guy in India who goes away and he comes back home, and his wife has built this huge house onto their house, and he says, "How did you do that?" And she says, I won the Indian state lotto. And he said, how did you do that? She said, I kept having a reoccurring dream, four sevens, four sevens, four sevens. And he said, what'd you do? She said, I bet 29. And he said, four sevens are 28. She said, you be the mathematician. I got the house, you know, like, you know. So relax and enjoy each other. And please, please remember this above all. We're just here on loan for one another. Our whole purpose for being sober, our whole purpose in Al-Anon, I would think, is to be spiritually centered so that you realize that this was never about him or her or it. It was about you all the time. And that as you get more and more comfortable, you will be more and more comfortable. You know, I'm sure you heard the story, and I'm going to close with this, of the little boy who wanted his father to play ball with him. And the dad was too busy reading the paper. And the kid kept yanking on him to come play ball with him. And then finally, the father got a little tired of it, so he went in the kitchen and grabbed the scissors and he cut up a picture of the world that was in the paper. And he said to the kid, when you put this picture of the world together, come get me and I'll play ball with you. And he left. So the kid was in the kitchen just a few minutes and he came, told his father that the world was together. The father said, are you sure? He said, yeah. So he went in the kitchen and there were the continents all in place. There was the rivers and oceans all in place. The world was perfect. And the father said, how did you do that? And he said, unbeknownst to you, Dad, on the other side of the picture of the world was a picture of a man. And as soon as I put the man together, the world just fell into shape. God bless you.